Great thing about America is here, kings and dictators do not rule, the people do.
We'll see. Hope you're right.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It is not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN. Got a few Ohio stories today. In Palinville, New York on WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADRM, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950. KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe for you every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and on most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Desi Doyen, we have got a lot to get to today.
Yes, I know.
But we do need to begin here in an historic, solemn, just over 10-minute speech from the White House on Wednesday night during prime time from behind the Resolute desk in the Oval Office. President Joe Biden explained his reasons for stepping down from his bid for a second term and discussed his hopes of passing the torch to his vice president, Kamala Harris, in hopes of best continuing his fight for the, quote, soul of the nation and, quote, in defense of democracy. That fight for the soul of the nation and in defense of democracy led to his initial campaign in 2020.
I revere this office, but I love my country more. It's been the honor of my life to serve as your president. But in the defense of democracy, which is at stake, I think it's more important than any title. I believe America is at an inflection point. We have to decide, do we still believe in honesty, decency, respect, freedom, justice, and democracy? In this moment, we can see those we disagree with not as enemies, but as friends, as fellow Americans. Can we do that? Does character and public life still matter? I believe I know the answer to these questions, because I know you, the American people, and I know this. We are a great nation because we are good people. When you elect me to this office, I promise to always level with you, to tell you the truth. And the truth, the sacred cause of this country, is larger than any one of us. And those of us who cherish that cause, cherish it so much, a cause of American democracy itself, must unite to protect it. You know, in recent weeks, it's become clear to me that I need to unite my party in this critical endeavor. I believe my record as president, my leadership in the world, my vision for America's future, all merited a second term. But nothing, nothing can come in the way of saving our democracy. That includes personal ambition. So I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation. That's the best way to unite our nation. I ran for president 4 years ago because I believed and still do that the soul of America was at stake. The very nature of who we are was at stake. And that's still the case. America's an idea. An idea stronger than any army, bigger than any ocean, more powerful than any dictator or tyrant. We're all created equal, endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. We've never fully lived up to it, to this sacred idea, but we've never walked away from it either. And I do not believe the American people will walk away from it now. In just a few months, the American people will choose the course of America's future. I made my choice. I've made my views known. I would like to thank our great Vice President, Kamala Harris. She's experienced, she's tough, she's capable. She's been an incredible partner to me and a leader for our country. Now the choice is up to you, the American people. When you make that choice, remember the words of Benjamin Franklin's hanging on my wall here in the Oval Office, alongside the busts of Dr. King and Rosa Parks and Cesar Chavez. When Ben Franklin was asked, as he emerged from the convention going on, whether the founders had given America a monarchy or a republic, Franklin's response was, a republic, if you can keep it. A republic, if you can keep it. Whether we keep our republic is now in your hands. Great thing about America is here, kings and dictators do not rule, the people do. History is in your hands. The power is in your hands. The idea of America lies in your hands. We just have to keep faith, keep the faith. And remember who we are. We're the United States of America. And there's simply nothing, nothing beyond our capacity when we do it together. So let's act together. Preserve our democracy. God bless you all. May God protect our troops. Thank you.
President Biden in somber but clearly heartfelt remarks, speaking from the Oval Office during a primetime address on Wednesday night, in what I thought was a moving, probably very difficult, but ultimately selfless speech, explaining to the nation both his reason for dropping out of the race, highlighting his administration's accomplishments, which I didn't have time to include in that clip there today.
Which were, you know, quite a few.
His hopes for his final 6 months in office. Yes, he still will be the president for the next 6 months, including, importantly, his, quote, call for Supreme Court reform because this is critical to our democracy, he said.
That's a big deal.
And not a moment too soon. And explaining why he was calling on Vice President Kamala Harris, representing a younger generation, and the American people themselves, calling on them to carry on that fight, as he put it, quote, in defense of democracy. Now, for me, I must say, the central takeaway in watching this speech, frankly, was how unimportant in many ways that Joe Biden himself was to that speech. I felt like it was almost as if he himself did not actually matter here, that it was about the nation, about the office, and more importantly than anything, about our constitutional democratic republic. He didn't even matter in one sense, or at least that's how it felt to me. Which, by the way, is a speech and a tone that in virtually every way imaginable, I cannot even fathom someone like Donald Trump ever delivering, at least with any actual sincerity in doing so, which, if nothing else, Joe Biden's, clearly was sincere during those remarks, love them or hate them, on Wednesday night. As you know, we have always taken that charge in defense of democracy very seriously on this program and at bradblog.com. And of course, we will continue to do so. At a moment, as the president suggested there, when American democracy itself is at one of its most perilous moments of challenge. I got a number of stories along those lines today, but do allow me to begin here. In a very rare unanimous vote, at least on anything of substance, the U.S. House on Wednesday voted 416 to zero to establish a task force to investigate the July 13 assassination attempt at a Donald Trump rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. The 13-member task force will be comprised of 7 Republican and 6 Democratic members, and they will have subpoena power. The vote, this unanimous vote, underscores the bipartisan outrage over the shooting where the former president and now Republican presidential nominee came within inches of losing his life. One rally-goer was killed, and 2 others were severely injured. Lawmakers on both the right and the left have responded quickly with hearings and widespread calls for accountability. House committees have already held 3 hearings focusing on the shooting. Well, that was quick. That shooting happened nearly 2 weeks ago, including a hearing on the Monday of this past week, which led to the resignation of Secret Service Director Kimberly Cheadle after she appeared before a congressional committee and she was berated for hours by both Democrats and Republicans alike for the security failures leading to the attempted assassination. Democrats voiced support for this newly formed task force this week, saying what happened in Butler was a despicable attack that never should have happened. Quote, "We need to know what happened. We need to get to the truth," said Congressman Jim McGovern, Democrat from Massachusetts, before voting along with all of his colleagues on both sides of the aisle to form this special task force. Well, that's good. I hope that this task force will find out what happened and will get to the truth. McGovern is absolutely right. We need that. America needs that. History needs that. We need to prevent whatever security failures happen. We need to prevent that from happening again, as McGovern also argued, and we need to know what actually happened in the first place. What didn't happen, at least according to all the currently available evidence, is what Trump claimed happened. His repeated assertion in social media postings and at the Republican National Convention and during campaign stump speeches ever since that, quote, he, quote, took a bullet for democracy. Now, BradBlog.com legal analyst Ernie Canning wrote a piece this week at the blog detailing the FBI's failure to find any evidence to date that the shooting was politically motivated. He went on to explain how other such shootings, including the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan in 1981, was done, according to the shooter, in a misguided attempt to impress then young actress Jodie Foster, with whom he was obsessed. So that was not politically motivated either, despite the fact that it targeted a political figure. But of course, none of that has prevented Donald Trump from using that event to his political advantage by repeatedly, and by all accounts and evidence falsely, claiming that he, quote, took a bullet for democracy. You can read Ernie's short piece at BradBlog.com on that. But beyond that, as Josh Marshall writes today at Talking Points Memo, quote, let's consider political candidate Fred Smith. Routinely, during his speeches, Fred talks about how he was shot by someone trying to kill him and only miraculously survived. That, says Josh, is a great candidate story, but imagine that then it turned out that it wasn't clear that Fred had actually been shot at all. He may have just been nicked by flying debris, while other people were actually seriously wounded and, yes, even killed. What's your experience as a consumer of political news, he asks, about how reporters generally react to that kind of news development? He asks not how they should react, but maybe how they do. He says, my experience is that they do not react very well at all. Indeed, they often press for crazy and over-the-top levels of details, and just when the person knew that his story either wasn't or might not be true. And if our candidate Fred Smith isn't forthcoming, the story quickly expands into meta discussions about the character and the credibility of this candidate. And I would add, in turn, his fitness for office, if he's willing to lie about something like that. Some of these aspects of press behavior will go beyond what's necessary and move into obsessive and nitpicking, writes Josh, but that is how they operate. But here, in fact, the media has done virtually the exact opposite. While asking a whole bunch of questions in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, in particular about the condition of the former president, they just seem to have stopped almost dead in their tracks from asking questions altogether once Trump took to his social media site and he claimed that a bullet had ripped through his ear. After that, they suddenly didn't have any more questions, apparently. And he's been repeating that claim and playing it up as him having taken, quote, a bullet for democracy ever since. Even though the actual evidence about what actually happened to Trump during that assassination attempt, and yes, it absolutely was an assassination attempt, no matter the motive behind it, no matter what hit or didn't hit Donald Trump. And yes, by the way, Trump was clearly wounded somehow during that attack. Even if the actual evidence about what happened does not suggest that he was grazed by a bullet, much less rather a bullet ripping through his ear, but rather by something else, like some sort of shrapnel, some glass from a teleprompter that was shattered by one of the attempted assassin's bullets. Now, Josh Marshall has been pounding on this story for a while, and he has wondered, as he notes again today, why there was never any law enforcement briefing or qualified medical report on the Butler, Pennsylvania shooting incident or information of how Donald Trump was actually injured. He has noted that he was especially interested in this because originally Pennsylvania State Police briefed reporters that Trump had been hit by flying debris kicked up by the gunfire. And I remember that. I was following it very closely at the time. And that was, well, he did seem to be bleeding from his ear, but we believe he may have been struck by some shattered glass or something. But as Josh notes, the storyline changed as soon as Trump went on to Truth Social and announced that a bullet had hit his ear. From that moment, that was the story followed universally by the press. But as he notes on Wednesday, FBI Director Christopher Wray said, ironically, in response to a question from Ohio Republican Congressman Jim Jordan, that it is not clear whether Donald Trump was actually hit by a bullet or by debris that was kicked up by the gunfire. Here was a central part of that exchange between Jordan and the, by the way, Donald Trump appointed FBI Director Christopher Wray during the House hearing on Wednesday.
Where did all eight bullets go is, I guess, my question.
I don't have that in front of me. I'm happy to circle back and get that to you. It's assuming we have that information yet. As I said, I think with respect to former President Trump, there's some question about whether or not it's a bullet or shrapnel that, you know, that hit his ear. So it's conceivable, although, as I sit here right now, I don't know whether that bullet, in addition to, you know, causing the grazing, could have also landed somewhere else. But I believe we've accounted for all of the shots and the cartridges. So let us
It's my understanding that the very first one was the one that hit the president. Is that the very first shot, or is that not accurate?
As I sit here right now, I don't know the answer to that. I believe we know the answer to that. I just don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
So the sitting FBI director, in the first actual official comment on this part of the story, really, from any credible law enforcement officer or medical officer, almost 2 weeks after the assassination attempt on a former president and a current presidential candidate, is that there is, quote, some question about whether or not it's a bullet or shrapnel that hit his ear. As the well-respected veteran journalist John Harwood, formerly of Wall Street Journal, New York Times, NBC, CNN, as he observed on Twitter following Ray's remarks in the House committee hearing on Wednesday, the FBI director's comment about whether it was a bullet or shrapnel that hit Trump, it, quote, underscores the question of why a former president injured in an assassination attempt will not put forward the doctors who treated him to say exactly what the injury was. Well, it sure does raise that underscore that question, doesn't it? As Josh Marshall has reported, after the shooting, Pennsylvania State Police were briefing reporters that Trump had been hit by flying glass. Flying debris, shards of glass, shrapnel, these are basically the same thing, he says. Tiny, hard objects kicked up at a high velocity by bullet impacts. And here's an interesting part of this story. Four local police officers who were just feet away from Donald Trump when those shots were fired also received minor injuries from flying debris from the bullets. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
I did not know that either until I had been following Josh's coverage of this. And that sort of seems noteworthy in this case, no? He also notes today that it seems probable that Secret Service agents may have been hit as well. But we simply have not gotten those details. The only reports about the local police officers being hit by flying shrapnel came from the police department itself and appeared solely in the local press. Then Trump went on Truth Social, announced he'd been struck in the air with a bullet, and that the story then changed. All mainstream media simply took Trump's word for it and ran with that version of the story, and that is sort of where we are now. Let's be honest, writes Josh, Trump is a notoriously self-promoting pathological liar. This is hardly a controversial statement. He says, I think even many of his own supporters would concede that point. From a journalistic standpoint, the idea that anyone would simply take his word for this is bizarre, a total journalistic failure. Not only is Trump thoroughly unreliable, he says, it's not clear he would have even known one way or another what hit him. One can be generous and say that maybe he thought it was true. A 20-year-old with a typical school shooter, mass shooter profile tried to kill Donald Trump and might very easily have succeeded, Josh notes. That's the core reality. But in every case, in anything like, you know, anything like this, we get and expect to get briefed by law enforcement and medical personnel about what they believed happened. In this case, uniquely, that never did, which he says is another significant failure. He says it's not that we're looking for deep, dark secrets. This is genuinely major, a genuinely major historical incident. The public hears from law enforcement about what happened, about the details. That's just how it works. In this case, it's hard not to believe that it didn't work that way, at least in part, because it necessarily involved stepping on the crisp storyline that Trump himself branded onto it in the immediate aftermath. He rapidly raised the stakes for contradicting him by making his story that he took a bullet for democracy, the central message of his entire convention. So why is this happening? Josh reports that he learned over the last week that at the upper echelons of the major press organizations, there was a clear understanding that there was no real basis for Trump's story, notwithstanding the fact that all of those organizations ran with it nonetheless as the central part of their coverage. The consensus, he says, from the folks at those outlets seemed to be that the bullet story was just Trump's opinion, but they appear to have been pretty open among themselves that it simply wasn't a big enough deal to merit getting into a public fight with him about this, with a fight with the Trump campaign. And he says, as we know, it would definitely be a fight to even ask for additional details about the story that quickly became the central element of what amounted to Trump's canonization in Milwaukee. Now, if we are going to be fighting for democracy, in defense of democracy, as President Biden described it during his Oval Office remarks on Wednesday night, And the main person putting that democracy at risk, Donald Trump, is actually making a claim that he, quote, took a bullet for democracy. Well, it kind of seems to me, you know, that feet should be held to the fire about whether that claim is actually true in any way, shape, or form. And the fact that the media just is not bothering to find out or even to ask questions, they're not even trying to, even though 2 weeks on now, we have not had a single official, credible briefing on what actually happened to the former president during an assassination attempt from any law enforcement officer, much less medical professional. That is an utter failure of our media, as underscored by the FBI director, Christopher Wray, saying it, you know, 2 weeks later, we're not even sure if it was a bullet or if it was some sort of shrapnel. One of the things that fascism and tyranny expert and author Timothy Snyder has warned over and over and over again when it comes to how societies fall to autocracy and, frankly, how they must fight to stave off autocracy in defense of democracy is to not obey in advance. To not obey with the autocrat in advance, to not assume that if, you know, you take a certain action, you will be opposed by the autocrat. So therefore, just don't take that action. And in the bargain, hand over power to the autocrat without ever waging a fight. So that appears to be exactly what our mainstream corporate media are now doing. Handing over power. Obeying in advance. It's just not worth the fight. I would say it is worth the fight. And of course, all of that ends up sending the message to the autocrat that you can do or you can say anything you want and we will not challenge you because, you know, it's just not worth it. That, even when we are talking about democracy itself and the man who has already sought to undermine it with a coup against the U.S. government itself, and is now holding himself up as the protector of democracy, a man who has already taken a bullet for democracy, as he loves to say, over and over again since that happened, and no one's challenged him, and this is just plain nuts, frankly. Though it does explain why Trump, during the convention in Milwaukee, said he was only going to talk about what happened this one time. And I shall never speak of it again. Because as he claimed at the time, it was just too painful. Really? Was it just too painful? Or was it that maybe it didn't happen? And it was just that he did not want to take any questions about it because he most likely knows that his claim is untrue. And of course, he continues to claim that he took a bullet for democracy. That part, he's more than happy to keep repeating over and over and over again because he has now made clear that asking any actual details about what actually happened, well, that is not allowed. And our media has agreed to obey in advance, to go along with that in advance. And they're not even going to ask because it's just, you know, it's just not worth the fight. So contrast all of that, of course, with the way that the media just flipped out over what appears to have been false reporting that a neurologist, a Parkinson's expert, had visited the White House 8 times in recent months to examine the president. In that case, the media certainly did not obey in advance when pressing a Democratic president for some reason, and at the time a presidential candidate, about his medical condition. That they had no problem doing, did they? So I am very happy that the U.S. House has unanimously voted to create a task force to determine the truth about what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania on July 13th, and how to ensure that something like that never happens again. Good. But to do that, they do need to fully determine the full story. And I really hope that they do, because the American people deserve to know about something as hugely historic as this event. As Josh Marshall concludes, the fact that Trump now routinely says he, quote, took a bullet for democracy as a way to deflect from any bad story or question gives some indication of why reporters should not drop asking basic questions just to avoid the anger of the people that they're covering. It seems quite likely, he says, that the story Trump has been telling constantly over the last 2 weeks simply is not true. And that he and his campaign know it is not true, or at least that there is no evidence for it, and the fact that the press knows that too. Some of the press hesitation is explained, he says, if not quite justified by the true gravity of what happened, a genuine near-miss assassination and massive shooting attempt that could have dramatically changed the course of American history, but that's no excuse for dropping the most basic blocking and tackling of ordinary reporting. And I would add, particularly when this apparent lie is being used in an extraordinary, cynical defense of our democracy by the very man who most threatens it right now. So, yeah, I'm glad Josh Marshall has been pressing on this. I'm glad that others have joined that battle. I hope that he gets pressed on this. I hope they do take up that fight. I hope they stop obeying in advance. All right. Our actual defense of democracy will continue after a quick break here with some encouraging, at least for now, voting news out of Ohio. Actually, we got a number of Ohio-related voting and democracy stories for you straight ahead. And Desi Doyen will have our latest Green News report on just a few of the startling plans to undermine climate science and, the environment itself in the GOP's Project 2025. All of that is straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
From the gates of hell, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, before we get to Ohio, we're starting to get an idea of how all of this is going to work timeline-wise, Desi Doyen,
yes,
over the next week or so regarding the change at the top of the ticket.
In the Democratic Party,
in the Democratic Party. Why, has there been talk of change in the
No, just
Republican?
Being specific.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Democratic National Convention delegates can make Vice President Kamala Harris their presidential nominee and even start approving her yet-to-be-named running mate, once she names one, I guess, in online voting beginning next week as the party races to coalesce around a new top of its ticket heading into November. The convention's rules committee on Wednesday passed a proposal where delegates from around the country will be able to vote on potential presidential nominees to replace Joe Biden, who, as you may have heard, stepped down from his reelection bid on Sunday. But Harris is currently, so she's the only major Democrat to announce publicly that she is seeking that nomination. And as of now, she will almost certainly be approved by the delegates. Reportedly, she has more than enough to win the nomination. So in theory, she will almost certainly be approved in a single round of virtual balloting beginning August 1, some 18 days before the party's convention opens in Chicago. Now, anyone who knows me knows I do not like virtual balloting. Internet voting, never a good idea, although it's at least a bit more overseeable in this case. And there's a reason why they're doing it, and I'll get to that in a second. AP notes that any potential Democrats willing to challenge Kamala Harris, who a majority of delegates have indicated they will be supporting, must submit 300 electronic signatures from convention delegates in order to be on that ballot. If multiple candidates end up qualifying, well, that could spark multiple rounds of voting over several days. Though, for that to happen, a challenger would need to work very quickly at this point to get onto the ballot. If Harris is the only candidate, then voting would begin on August 1. You could mark that on your calendars. So, why are they doing this? Why aren't they doing all of this before the convention, which begins on August 19? Well, it is not to prevent another candidate from, you know, gathering support and mucking up their devious plans to put Kamala Harris onto the top of the ticket, or, you know, to prevent even a chaotic open convention or some such. It is, in fact, thanks to Republicans in Ohio that they have to do this. And it's related to a story that we had been covering for some months on this program, going back, I think, to the beginning of the year. As listeners may recall, Ohio's statutory deadline for when party candidates had to be certified by their parties and submitted to the state, that deadline was on August 7. And August 7 comes before this year's scheduled Democratic convention. Now, when that has happened in the past, as it did with late Republican conventions, for example, for Donald Trump in 2020 and for Mitt Romney in 2012, state lawmakers simply passed a simple statutory fix to allow the party candidates to be submitted to the state just a little bit later that year after the convention. No problem. But now the state's extremely partisan Republican gerrymandered legislature, well, they spent weeks and months avoiding changing that law, changing that deadline, as we had been reporting. And as you remember, if you had heard, I was saying, I don't know if this is a story. I don't know if this is important or not. It seems like it might be.
Oh, yeah. You were saying that way back when, just like, hey, you know, yeah. Normally in the past, they've had no issue with this. But we're talking about the Ohio Republican state legislature. They do things like that.
So, yeah, it turns out it was a story, and it is affecting a lot even now. So they spent weeks, months avoiding making a change to the deadline. So at that time, Democrats decided, well, you know what we'll do? We'll simply hold a virtual roll call to certify the candidate, who was at the time Joe Biden. There was no real question about who it was going to be. We'll certify that candidate virtually before the party's actual convention in Chicago in mid-August. Now, eventually, in a late special session that was called for the state legislature, Republicans finally came around and they passed a new law that would change the deadline for submitting official nominee names until September after the Democratic convention. How thoughtful of them. But nonetheless, Democrats are still planning on this early virtual roll call for some reason. And that reason is basically they don't trust that the state Republicans will do the right thing, and of course they have good reason to feel that way. Ohio state lawmakers apparently changed the deadline, but this new law does not actually take effect until September 1. And so I guess technically the Democrats would be in violation of the law if they don't submit their nominee before August 7. So DNC attorneys have warned that waiting until after the initial deadline to determine a presidential nominee, well, that could prompt legal challenges.
by Republicans.
Exactly. So in other words, the DNC lawyers are saying there is a window of opportunity for shenanigans. We need to shut that down.
And they're saying, yeah, to play it safe, Democrats want to submit their nominee to the Buckeye State before the old deadline, since for now, that's the law that's actually in effect until September 1. Got it? That is why the roll call vote will actually begin on August 1, or at least that's when it is set to currently begin, on August 1, and will be completed no later than August 7th.
Because of the Ohio Republican Party.
Right, the old deadline. That, according to DNC Chair Jamie Harrison, and a vice presidential candidate must also be chosen and certified by delegates as well by that date, by August 7th. So all of this is going to happen very quickly. Got it? Now, as to that gerrymandered Ohio legislature, well, we've got some seemingly good news today for you on that, for democracy and specifically for Ohio voters, maybe voters across the nation, since this also affects U.S. House seats out of Ohio. According to the Cincinnati Inquirer, it's official: Ohioans will vote on whether to remove politicians from both congressional and state house redistricting this November. Citizens, not politicians, the group backing a redistricting amendment, submitted enough valid signatures to make the fall ballot, according to the Ohio Secretary of State on Tuesday. According to retired Ohio Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor, who is a Republican, by the way, she's just not an insane one. She helped to draft this amendment. She said, quote, "This certification is a historic step toward restoring fairness in Ohio's electoral process. With this amendment on the ballot," she says, "Ohioans will have the chance to reclaim their power from the self-serving politicians who want to stay in power long past their expiration date while ignoring the needs of the voters." But, of course, the measure will be facing opposition from, can you guess who? Current Republican lawmakers, like Ohio Senate Republican spokesperson John Fortney, who said, quote, "This campaign should be called political outcomes over people." Whatever, John. The proposed constitutional amendment would, in fact, remove elected officials from drawing their own congressional and state legislative districts. Instead, a 15-member panel of 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 5 independents would craft the maps if, in fact, this state constitutional amendment is adopted by voters this November. Active lobbyists, political consultants, and elected officials could not serve on that panel, which retired judges would help to select. The proposed amendment comes after Ohioans overwhelmingly approved redistricting reform previously in both 2015 and 2018, but those amendments put the map-making pen in the hands of those lawmakers and statewide elected officials. Between 2021 and 2022, Republicans held the majority of seats on the Ohio Redistricting Commission, as the Ohio Supreme Court repeatedly ruled that Republicans crafted maps that unfairly benefited GOP candidates. If Ohioans approve the citizen redistricting panel, this new one, the new commission will then craft new maps for the 2026 election. So they still get corrupt maps in 2024 in Ohio for the Republicans, but that will change in 2026, presuming voters do what they need to do. If voters reject the measure, Ohio's current Republican gerrymandered maps will last until 2030 at a minimum.
Wow. And it just shows that if you're in a state that is trying to get an independent, citizen-led initiative up on the board for that, remember, the details matter. It
yes.
matters who is appointing the people who will be on the redistricting yep. commission.
So, yeah, this is also going to be on the ballot this Ohio this year, making the ability of voters to actually be able to vote in the state, the Buckeye State, overseen by the wildly partisan Republican Secretary of State Frank LaRose. It makes this election even more important than it already was. You may recall that LaRose last year did everything that he absolutely could in an effort to derail an amendment that adds protections for reproductive rights to the Ohio State Constitution. Happily, LaRose failed hugely in that matter, and it ended up costing him the nomination for the U.S. For the Republican U.S. Senate seat this November. Anyway, he failed on that, and democracy won. But the GOP attempts at voter suppression, those are going to continue nonetheless. And on that, we also have some good news out of Ohio today. A federal judge has struck down part of Ohio's sweeping 2023 election law this week, which voting rights groups said restricted people from helping voters with disabilities to cast their absentee ballots. Voting rights advocates argued that the Republican-backed law went too far by prohibiting anyone but a very few qualifying family members from helping people with disabilities to be able to deliver their ballots, excluding potential helpers like professional caregivers or roommates or in-laws or even grandchildren.
Wow. I mean, that's just mind-blowing.
They described the decision, voting rights advocates described the decision this week issued by a U.S. District Court judge in Cleveland as a victory for democracy and voters. Quote, "We are thrilled that the court ordered the state to stop denying Ohioans with disabilities the opportunity to cast their ballots via assistance from a trusted person of their choice. This is the correct reading of the Voting Rights Act," said Frieda Levinson, the legal director for the ACLU of Ohio, "and a validating decision for Ohio voters." The League of Women Voters of Ohio and voter Jennifer Cusera, who was born with a form of muscular dystrophy, filed a lawsuit in December under the Americans with Disabilities Act against the state's Republican Secretary of State, Frank LaRose.
It is also a victory, of course, for the disabled community to be able to choose the people that they wish to choose rather than having Republicans tell them who they are allowed to choose.
It's amazing. The law apparently took effect last year in April. Also, it made it a felony for anyone. So not only could you not do this, but it made it a felony for anyone who is not an election official or a mail carrier to possess or return the absentee ballot of a voter with a disability unless the person assisting them qualified as a close relative. And again, grandchildren, apparently not a close relative.
Jeez.
Republicans who backed this law argued its provisions were designed to protect election integrity and restore voter confidence at a time of great doubt among GOP voters. Golly, I wonder why this has become a time of great doubt among GOP voters. The ruling this week comes, as AP notes in its coverage, as former President Donald Trump and his Republican allies continue to spread false claims that there was widespread fraud in the 2020 presidential election, which, by the way, in Ohio, Donald Trump won bigly, as he might say. But still, they got to change the law. Voting rights advocates in Ohio say many voters with disabilities are unable to travel to their polling places, and many are unable to even access their mailboxes or ballot drop boxes. But if you give it to your grandkid to drop into the mailbox, well,
that's a felony.
That's a felony for the grandkid. For the record, by the way, people with disabilities make up about a quarter of the U.S. adult population. So this is not, you know, oh, it's just a few people. This is a quarter of the U.S. adult population that, according to the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So in truth, that's a lot of voters that these folks could end up suppressing if these kinds of laws are allowed to go through, whether it's in Ohio or other states where Republicans are doing whatever they can to keep, you know, certain people from being able to cast their vote and participate in their own democracy, which we will always stand in defense of. All right. In not entirely unrelated news, Desi Doyen in the Green News Report is up next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Well, Desiree, I would say that your report today, your GNR today, is also, in a way, in defense of democracy.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. As you will learn in our latest Green News Report.
It looks like it's going to be another monster of a fire year here in the Pacific Northwest.
Explosive wildfire season worsens in Canada and Western U.S. Earth just had its hottest 2 days ever recorded thanks to global warming.
Thanks, global warming.
Plus,
can you believe they put that thing in writing?
Republicans' Project 2025 would gut federal science agencies, the EPA, and force you to pay for your free weather reports.
Sounds great. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Now, Kamala gets away, you will no longer get to enjoy gas-powered vehicles or plastic straws. I don't know about you. I hate the paper straws. It'll ruin any drink.
Man, talk about grasping at straws. Good luck with that, Sean Hannity. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, I don't know about you, but I'm getting kind of tired of living through history when history means, hey, everyone on the planet has just lived through the hottest day ever recorded.
Yep. The European Union's Climate Service confirmed that Monday, July 22nd, 2024, was the hottest day ever recorded globally on planet Earth. And it broke the previous all-time high temperature record set just one day earlier as deadly heat waves continue to broil large swaths of the world. 2024 is now virtually certain to surpass 2023 as the hottest year on record, driven by humanity's burning of fossil fuels. Yet scientists warn this is likely the coolest summer of the rest of our lives.
Well, if we're going to start listening to scientists' warnings now.
They also point out that decisions that ordinary citizens and leaders make now about energy, transportation, food systems, and more will determine how much more warming humanity faces in coming decades. Across the North American West, the extreme heat has dried out forests, triggering a ferocious fire season.
Why didn't the scientists warn us about that?
They did.
Oh.
In Oregon, 31 large fires are active, four of them mega fires, after more than 2 months without any rain. Canada is grappling with hundreds of wildfires, including a major fire that has forced evacuations at popular Jasper National Park. Like last year's record-shattering fire season, toxic wildfire smoke has spread, compromising air quality as far south as Denver and Chicago. In U.S. politics, by now you probably have heard about Project 2025.
No, what's that?
That is the sweeping far right-wing game plan for Donald Trump, or the next Republican president, compiled by the Heritage Foundation and former Trump administration officials, that seeks to transform the federal government into a tool to establish right-wing authoritarian rule.
Emphasis on tool.
Focusing just on the environment, Project 2025 would sabotage science-based policies and jettison much of the federal government's climate science apparatus and the data used to adapt society and infrastructure to threats.
Sounds great.
Reversal of the Pentagon's planning around climate change, removal of all climate change targets in government services from how cities are zoned to efficiency and resilience standards for taxpayer-funded construction projects. Also, a massive paring back of the Environmental Protection Agency's abuse powers, a rapid acceleration of drilling for natural gas and oil, a repeal of President Biden's landmark emissions and pollution standards. It would cut off subsidies and rebates for electric vehicles and clean energy projects. It would prioritize the cost of regulations to industry over the costs to public health. And it would stop Department of Energy research into renewable energy, battery storage, and other new technologies.
Who wouldn't want that?
Critically, Project 2025 also proposes breaking up NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is the parent agency for the National Weather Service.
So that we can charge everyone for their weather forecasts?
Yes. It describes NOAA as, quote, one of the main drivers of the climate change alarm industry, and claims U.S. climate research is, quote, harmful to future U.S. prosperity.
Man.
And it calls for a Republican administration to privatize and commercialize taxpayer-funded weather data and forecasting now done by government agencies, which would force farmers, business, and the general public to pay for their free weather reports, including hurricane forecasts. It would replace career civil servants and scientists, opening the agency up to political meddling. Remember when Donald Trump used a Sharpie to incorrectly suggest Hurricane Dorian could impact Alabama? It'd be like that.
So we're going to get more of that.
Exactly. The changes called for in Project 2025 lay out the high stakes and stark choices facing voters in the 2024 election.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, grab your Sharpie and head to greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Oh, man. I tell you what, that Project 2025 story is a story that just keeps on giving. 900 pages. There is so much in there that is so terrifying and horrifying. Thank you for pulling out those details as you did, Desi.
Yeah, and that's just a really quick rundown of sort of broader points of it. It's much, much, much worse when you actually read through just the section alone on environment, climate, and energy, and the vision that the Republicans at the Heritage Foundation have for America is really scary, and is it guaranteed to make climate change as horrific as possible for everybody living now and in the future. And I am not kidding.
Yeah, no, I know you're not. It is. It's even worse than it sounds, folks. All right,
yes.
We got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other that we have ever done, you can download it anytime for free, no paywall, at bradblog.com. That is thanks to those of you who hit one of those donate buttons over there, or you go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves and help us continue to defend democracy and the planet. Thanks in advance. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Paradise, put up a parking lot.